Hello, my name is Dr. David Rubin. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Chicago. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity. It's titled, Caring for Patients with IBD in an Evolving Treatment Landscape, Optimizing Outcomes and Minimizing Complications. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians around the globe. Our goal for today's activity is to help you implement strategies to optimize treatment outcomes in IBD patients. Again, I'm Dr. David Rubin, but I'm really delighted to tell you that joining me today in the studio is my colleague and former fellow, Dr. Jamie Kanukin. Dr. Kanukin is an assistant professor of medicine and program director of IBD fellowship education at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Also joining us today live via Skype will be Dr. Gil Melmed. Dr. Melmed is co-director of the Clinical Inflammatory Bowel Disease in the Division of Gastroenterology at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Gil, thank you for joining us remotely today.
Thanks for having me, David.
Yeah, you sound great. I also want to make sure our audience is aware that today's program has been designated to meet the requirements of both mock and as a MIPS improvement activity. Your active participation, asking a question and completing the evaluation and post-test, is the first step in that process. After today's program, incorporate the clinical improvements we discuss, and in a few months, CME Outfitters will send you a survey that will fulfill the data collection requirement. Of course, you have to answer the survey. You will then receive a confirmation that you can submit to CMS. It's really that easy. Make sure to ask us your questions. Focus on simple changes you can make in your practice. Integrate them into your practice, and then let us know how it's impacted your patients, and you'll be on your way to receiving confirmation of your participation in this MIPS improvement activity. Again, the title of our program today is Caring for Patients with IBD in an Evolving Treatment Landscape, Optimizing Outcomes and Minimizing Complications. So let's start with our first learning objective. Evaluate Janus kinase inhibitors for inflammatory bowel disease in terms of mechanism, efficacy, and safety. And what I'm going to do is actually start by reviewing the current treatment options for moderate to severely active IBD. This table that I've put together is updated with all the therapies we currently have available and have been approved by the FDA for the treatment of inflammatory bowel disease. You can see that it's oriented with the treatments in the first column, the different phases of management in the second and third columns, specifically induction and maintenance, and then some additional dosing comments and treatment considerations. Of course, steroids remain an appropriate induction therapy for many of our patients with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, but are not appropriate for maintenance. And in fact, our goals for management are specific in that they say we should be avoiding steroids in maintenance. Thiopurines remain an option for some patients, predominantly for maintenance in Crohn's and UC, and almost always after steroid induction. Methotrexate is an appropriate option for both induction and maintenance in Crohn's disease, but randomized trials have now demonstrated that it is not effective for the treatment of ulcerative colitis. We have several classes of monoclonal antibodies and biological treatments for treating Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. The first one are the anti-integrin therapies, natalizumab and vedolizumab treating Crohn's disease, and vedolizumab, which will treat ulcerative colitis. Now, these therapies work by a mechanism that inhibits leukocyte trafficking. They actually prevent lymphocytes from migrating to the bowel. The second class of biological therapies, ustekinumab, is specifically an antibody against P40. P40 is a protein that is shared by two cytokines, IL-12 and IL-23, and ustekinumab is FDA approved for induction and maintenance in both moderate to severe Crohn's and moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. And of course, our third class of biological therapies are the anti-TNF therapies. In the United States, we have four different anti-TNF therapies that have been approved for the treatment of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis in both induction and maintenance. And they're listed there, adalimumab, certolizumab pegol, golimumab, and infliximab. And lastly, and the focus of part of our discussion tonight, is our first novel small molecule and the first JAK inhibitor approved for the treatment in IBD, which is called tofacitinib. It's a Janus kinase inhibitor that was approved for the treatment of moderate to severe ulcerative colitis last year. And we're going to discuss this further, and I'm actually going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Kanukin, to teach us a little bit about JAK inhibitors and how do we distinguish them from biological therapies. Take it away, Jamie.
Absolutely. So JAK inhibitors versus monoclonal antibodies or biologic therapies actually work intracellularly. These are synthetic drugs and not protein-based molecules, and they can be taken orally instead of injection or infusion-based therapies. Thus, they're not immunogenic, and this type of therapy leads to a stable and more predictable pharmacokinetics.
So oral and not monoclonal antibody, not protein-based. We have here an animation that I'd like to show the audience. We'll bring this up now. And this is an example of one of the things that can be seen on the CME Outfitters website in the GI Hub. And why don't you take us through, here's the basic structure of this animation, then we'll animate it. So Jamie, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, this first image that you're seeing is a cytokine, which is the red dot that's bound to a transmembrane receptor, and it's actually a JAK transmembrane receptor. You'll see the JAK protein in orange, which is also attached to a STAT protein, which is in pink. And then at the bottom of the image, you'll see a purple nucleus. And we'll show you what this animation looks like, both with activation as well as inhibition.
So now if I actually click on the animation here, tell us what's happening.
You can see a cytokine that's binding to the transmembrane receptor, and it's activating the JAK protein, which subsequently activates the STAT protein to form a dimer that enters the nucleus and then leads to the activation of pro-inflammatory genes within the nucleus and increases extracellular cytokines, thus making the process almost circular.
And the final animation here, the green represents our JAK inhibitor, right?
Yeah, and so when you see a JAK inhibitor, which is again an intracellular molecule, it's binding to the JAK protein. Even though the cytokine is present at the transmembrane receptor, you do not get further activation of the STAT protein, which is the pink molecule, and thus does not lead to intracellular or intranuclear activation of pro-inflammatory genes and no further cytokine production extracellularly.
That's great. So this entire class of therapy is now of interest in IBD. Of course, we only have one so far that's approved by the FDA. We're going to spend some more time talking about tofacitinib. But why don't you set up the landscape of JAK inhibition for us with this next slide?
Absolutely. So tofacitinib, as we talked about, is a pan-JAK inhibitor, which inhibits JAK 1, 2, and 3, and has FDA approval for ulcerative colitis. And we'll discuss in a little bit the phase 3 trials that have been done in Crohn's disease. Upadacitinib, which is a selective JAK1 inhibitor, is currently in phase 3 trials for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Filgotinib is also a selective JAK1 inhibitor that is currently in phase 3 trials for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. We also have TD-1473, which is again a pan-JAK inhibitor for 1, 2, and 3 that's being studied in both phase 2 and phase 3 studies for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And BMS-986165, TYK2, which is actually the first JAK discovered prior to JAK 1, 2, and 3, currently that is in phase 2 for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease.
And upadacitinib recently received FDA approval for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. So there's actually tofacitinib and upadacitinib that are available in the U.S. market. So let's go through some of the data for tofacitinib. Teach us what we know about it in ulcerative colitis.
Absolutely. So reviewing these phase 3 studies, the OCTAVE and OCTAVE SUSTAIN studies, there were actually 3 randomized controlled trials enrolling 1,200 patients with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. The OCTAVE 1 and 2 studies looked at 8-week outcomes of clinical remission, and you can see in this graph all the way to the left that there was statistically significant clinical remission over placebo in patients, in about 16 to 18% of patients that were taking tofacitinib 10 milligrams twice daily in the induction studies. Fast forward to the 52-week data in the OCTAVE SUSTAIN study, where patients who responded in the induction studies were then randomized to placebo, 5 milligrams twice daily, and 10 milligrams twice daily. And those patients had further response in terms of clinical remission, where you can see anywhere from 34 to 40% of patients achieved statistically significant clinical remission in the OCTAVE SUSTAIN study. Reminding you what clinical remission and clinical remission was defined as was a total Mayo score of less than or equal to 2, with no subscore greater than 1 and an absolute rectal bleeding score, subscore of 0. So patients could not have any presence of rectal bleeding both at 8 weeks as well as 52 weeks. And then if we look at the mucosal healing data, which was defined as a Mayo endoscopic score of either 0 or 1, so patients either had normal appearing mucosa or mild inflammation based on an endoscopic Mayo score, we can see that in the induction study looking at 8-week data for tofacitinib 10 milligrams twice daily, that anywhere from 28 to 31% of patients were able to achieve mucosal healing, which was statistically significant over placebo. And then when we look at the 52-week data for Octave Sustain, those patients that responded again in the 8-week, at 8 weeks, were then randomized to placebo, 5 milligrams twice daily, and 10 milligrams twice daily, with 37 to 45% of patients at 52 weeks having mucosal healing found on endoscopy.
Great. So this is very helpful. So two phases of management, like we've discussed, induction and then maintenance. And ultimately, the label was for 10 milligrams BID for 8 weeks, with the possibility of a second 8 weeks for delayed responders. And then in maintenance, we have the option of 5 or 10. And we'll talk more about that. What about in Crohn's disease?
Absolutely, David. There's phase 2 data that came for tofacitinib in Crohn's disease, both induction and maintenance. Again, looking at week 8 induction data, both at clinical response, which was defined as a CDAI score, so Crohn's disease activity index, with a change from baseline of 100 points or greater, or clinical remission, which was a CDAI score defined as an absolute score less than 150. And in this group of patients, when you look at the 5 milligram twice daily data, the 10 milligram twice daily data, while there was a numeric difference in clinical response and clinical remission, it did not meet statistical significance.
So it didn't work in Crohn's disease. Why didn't it work in Crohn's disease?
It's hard to say. It could be the mechanism being a pan-selective JAK inhibitor. It could be that maybe we're looking a little bit too soon, similar to what we've seen in other mechanisms in Crohn's disease versus ulcerative colitis. So it's really hard to say, David.
Okay, but it didn't get its label for Crohn's. We're going to focus on UC. Now tell us the update on safety with tofacitinib, because obviously this is important.
Yeah, and many of our viewers today probably have heard about this in the news and maybe don't understand how to interpret it completely. So this was based on phase 4 rheumatoid arthritis study that was done mainly looking at an older patient population over the age of 50 that had greater than 1 cardiovascular risk factor. And what they were looking at was outcomes for cardiovascular events, opportunistic infections, or malignancy in this patient population. And what they found, and not necessarily intentional, was that at a 10 milligram twice daily dosing, that there was an increased risk statistically significant for both pulmonary embolism and mortality in this RA patient population. Now, when they reviewed back, this was not seen in any of the phase 2 or phase 3 trials across all disease states. And so this was a surprising finding that came out of this phase 4 study.
It was. And so how has this been interpreted now for our management for patients?
Well, and because we typically use the 10 milligram dosing for patients with ulcerative colitis, at least at an induction, and some patients remain on it for maintenance, there was a open label extension study that went back to look to see if there was an increased risk for pulmonary embolism or DVT or mortality in our patients. And we did not see that in that phase.
No. Nor have we seen it in our own practices. And of course, colitis is a condition where people may be more likely to clot anyway. So there are clearly some unanswered questions about this here. And in general, now we've been screening our patients for additional risks, like being smokers, which is less common in ulcerative colitis, or having a prior history of clotting problems, which would obviously be something we'd want to be watching carefully. And by the FDA's recommendation, reducing the dose in maintenance to 5 milligrams BID, which was the dose at which there were no events that had been reported in that RA study. So take us through how we monitor patients and some of the other things we should be thinking about.
Absolutely. So because of the label change that happened as a result of both the phase 4 study and then the post-hoc evaluation in ulcerative colitis, we at the University of Michigan are screening all of our patients that we start on tofacitinib for venous thromboembolism risk factors, as well as cardiovascular risk factors, similarly to what they did in the phase 4 study. And then in addition, patients require pre-initiation labs, as listed on the label, as well as routine lab monitoring to ensure that they don't have any change in their baseline blood counts, as well as hemoglobin and liver enzymes, and of course, lipid panel, one of the things that was seen in the RA studies. So at initiation, we typically check a complete blood count as well as a complete metabolic panel, and we check baseline non-fasting lipids, follow those up at 4 to 8 weeks, and then every 3 months, we're getting routine labs on these patients for monitoring.
Okay. Well, the lipid change is something very interesting. It's about a 10% elevation of lipids after starting therapy that's stable over time. The HDL and LDL go up in the same ratio at which they were in the first place. So this isn't entirely clear, but that's what led to the RA study. The FDA wanted to know whether it increased the risk of cardiovascular events, and the surprise of the DVTs emerged. And it really needs to be studied some more before we'll fully understand it. We also are vaccinating everyone who we start on this therapy, and one of the challenges is vaccinating people who are under 50 because pharmacists are sometimes not able to give it, and there is a national shortage of the attenuated vaccine for zoster. Nonetheless, if you go to the cdc.gov website, it does discuss what are called special populations, which include those who are immune suppressed, and certainly vaccination for zoster in our patients with IBD. Whether they're getting tofacitinib or, frankly, some of our other immune suppression is definitely of concern and interest to us. All right, so in summary, we're talking about a novel therapy for ulcerative colitis that was approved last year. It is the first new small molecule we have, which means it's oral. It's not a biological therapy. The induction strategy is 10 milligrams twice daily for 8 weeks with the possibility of a second 8 weeks. And in maintenance phase, you have the dosing of either 5 or 10 milligrams twice daily with the emphasis on using the lowest effective dose for those patients. And we've talked a bit about the safety monitoring and precautions. So let's briefly talk about the other JAK inhibitors. We'll start with upadacitinib, which, as I mentioned, already has received approval for rheumatoid arthritis. What do we know about it in IBD?
Well, as we talked about earlier, David, it is a selective JAK1 inhibitor, so has a slightly more selective mechanism than the currently approved tofacitinib. And this is walking you through the ulcerative colitis induction study that is a phase 2B, you achieve, looking at, it's basically a dose-finding study, looking at endpoints at 8 weeks again, clinical remission, clinical response, and mucosal healing. And essentially what this found in both clinical response and clinical remission is that at all doses of upadacitinib, that we found that there was statistical significant difference over placebo in terms of response and remission. But in mucosal healing, really only saw the response or mucosal healing at 30 and 45 milligram dosing.
So interesting, and clearly something that's moving forward. Also, upadacitinib seems to work well in Crohn's, unlike what we saw with tofacitinib.
So the same, looking at a moderate to severe Crohn's disease population in those patients who failed more than two biologic, which in this particular case was anti-TNF therapies, they looked at, again, dose finding for both clinical response and clinical remission. And in this study, you can see that they chose a different endpoint of 16 weeks as compared to 8 weeks, which was we've been seeing for the tofacitinib data and then earlier for the ulcerative colitis data. Here you can see that really the main response that we see and statistical significance was really in clinical response, both at 6 milligrams and 24 milligrams, but didn't reach, only reached statistical significance at 0.1 in clinical remission at 6 milligrams. So not nearly as promising of data in Crohn's disease as ulcerative colitis, but certainly it looks a little bit better than the tofacitinib data that was out.
Clearly. But this was also a very tough to treat patient population, right? They intentionally set the bar pretty high by having patients who already failed more than two or more biological therapies. And lastly, filgotinib, another selective JAK1 inhibitor in Crohn's disease.
The Fitzroy phase 2 study looking at filgotinib, which was a 200 milligram once daily dosing of, again, a selective JAK1 inhibitor, looks at clinical response as well as clinical remission at week 10. Again, a little bit longer than the week 8 data. And you can see in this study in Crohn's patients that we can see both a clinical response as well as clinical remission at week 10, both statistically significant in this population for Crohn's disease. So looks a little bit better than some of the other data that we've seen.
Very nice. So I think we've shared with the audience tonight this new class of therapies that are available and being investigated for the treatment of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Tofacitinib is approved for the treatment of moderate to severe UC, and there are additional JAK inhibitors that are more selective that are being studied for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And it appears that selectivity for JAK1 will work better in Crohn's disease than was seen previously with the less selective tofacitinib. As with all therapies, we're thinking carefully about safety when we use these treatments, and we've learned from tofacitinib now that we need to screen patients for their risk of venous thromboembolic complications and use a lower dose in maintenance when possible. The label change has required that we use tofacitinib after exposure and or failure to anti-TNF therapies. Now, the challenge to that is that in post-hoc analysis of the TOFA phase 3 trials, patients who had already failed anti-TNF therapy seemed to do better with 10 milligrams in maintenance. So there's the paradox of wanting to be on lower dose but also needing it for those types of patients. So we're going to learn more about this as we move forward. Let's move on to our second learning objective and invite our guest faculty from Los Angeles to speak to us a little bit more. Gail, are you still out there?
I'm here, David.
All right, fabulous.
Can you hear me?
So, we can. Our second learning objective is to talk about how to monitor patients with IBD for iron deficiency and anemia. And in preparation for all this, we actually talked to some patients, and we have an audio clip from a patient who told us a little bit more about what their own experience about anemia and iron deficiency was. Are we able to play the audio clip?
My primary care doctor and I have talked a little bit about anemia, and he does do a check of my iron levels every 3 months, and they have diagnosed me with anemia at a few points, and so I was under the impression that the anemia could come and go because I don't always have a problem with my iron levels. I'm not aware of all of the risks of anemia, so maybe that's something that I should look into that I haven't.
I think that this is probably a pretty typical experience, which is that patients know that we check their blood count, they know that we might check their iron levels, but they don't necessarily understand how these things are linked, and very importantly, how they might indicate the disease, whether it's being controlled properly and how we should be monitoring them. So I'm really happy that you're going to teach us a little bit today about anemia and how to think better about our IBD patients.
Sure. Thanks, David. Yes, I think anemia is one of those aspects of care in general with patients with inflammatory bowel disease that many of us, myself certainly, kind of took for granted as going along with the disease and not necessarily recognizing it as a separate medical condition, certainly related, but that needed to be addressed and treated independently, and also one that had very significant impact both on individuals' quality of life as well as their resource utilization, as this slide shows very elegantly from University of Pittsburgh. And what you can see here is patients who were looked at in terms of their utilization for access of services, number of phone calls to their clinic, number of emergency room visits, GI department visits, and even hospitalizations seem to correlate very linearly with the duration for which a patient had experienced or had defined anemia. So the longer somebody had anemia, suddenly more than 3 years, as compared to somebody with anemia for only 1 to 2 years, as compared to somebody with no anemia, had escalating utilization of all of these services over the course of an assessment of how anemia actually impacts healthcare utilization. And I think this begs the question, you know, what's the chicken and what's the egg? Is it anemia driving these services, or is it that individual with anemia, certainly persistent anemia, is somebody perhaps who may also have undertreated or perhaps untreated disease, inflammatory bowel disease, or other aspects of why anemia actually may be so pervasive in that individual? But this association is really hard to escape, and something that we really need to think about when we see that a patient in front of us has low iron, has anemia, because of its association with all of these services.
So the CME Outfitters folks have put together another nice animation. Can you tell us a little bit more about what we're seeing here?
Yeah, I think this is a nice cartoon to depict that one of the causes, one of the obvious causes, I would say, in inflammatory bowel disease for anemia is blood loss. And, you know, anemia is quite prevalent in inflammatory bowel disease. One study here demonstrated 16% of outpatients and 68% of inpatients do meet criteria for anemia, and occurring more frequently in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, but one that's frequently overlooked, as I was just discussing. What we're seeing here in the cartoon is simply escape and loss of blood cells through the wall of a blood vessel, which may be compromised due to inflammation. We all know, those of us that certainly do endoscopy and see what the bowel looks like from the inside, can see the effects of inflammation leading to erosions and ulceration, where blood vessels are exposed to the luminal surface and what's in the blood vessels literally escapes. So we have here, a nice example of blood loss. But I think it's also important to recognize and remember that blood loss, while common in IBD, is not the only cause of anemia in patients with inflammatory bowel disease.
Absolutely. And of course, the other part would be underproduction. So let's talk a little bit about iron deficiency. Teach us what we should know.
Yeah, well, so like we were just discussing, iron deficiency occurs when we have loss of blood as one cause, because blood or red blood cells are where iron is essentially stored and transported in the body. And so loss of blood through the intestinal mucosa, commonly in ulcerative colitis, but also in Crohn's disease, is a very common cause of iron deficiency in terms of absolute loss of iron. Also, we have reduced iron absorption, which is perhaps more commonly seen in Crohn's disease due to impairment of intestinal bowel wall function and bowel wall absorption. And then also we see low dietary intake. I think this is often an overlooked cause of anemia because many of our patients may put themselves on selective diets where they are selectively removing certain iron-rich foods, for example, in their diet. They may be limiting their intake of green leafy vegetables that are good sources of iron. They may be limiting their intake of red meat for one reason or another because of how it makes them feel. And so recognizing that there are many factors that can contribute to an absolute loss of iron in the body. On the other hand, there's also what we call functional iron deficiency, which is not necessarily that if you measure the total amount of iron in the body that it's low, but there may be a relative diminishment of available iron, where iron itself may be abundant, but it's simply not available to generate healthy new red blood cells through erythropoiesis. And this is one of the newer aspects of our understanding of iron metabolism that relates to how inflammation actually can impair and interfere with iron metabolism, because when there's inflammation, we find that it becomes more difficult for iron to actually be absorbed through the enterocyte.
So, Gil, is this what we used to call the anemia of chronic disease?
Well, you know, I think that anemia of chronic disease itself is a mixed bag. It may be a contributor to anemia of chronic disease in patients with inflammatory bowel disease when that chronic disease is inflammation driven. And this perhaps may explain some of the anemia of chronic disease in inflammatory states.
So teach us a bit about what lab tests we need to order. I'm never sure which ones to start with and which ones to use in follow-up.
Yes, sure. Well, the most obvious lab test that we can do to look for anemia is a complete blood count or a CBC, where we are checking a hemoglobin, where we're directly measuring the amount of hemoglobin in the body. And, based on World Health Organization criteria, can determine whether somebody meets criteria for anemia, a hemoglobin of less than 12 in a man, less than 11 in a woman, or lower than that itself would meet criteria for anemia. But then you have to really try to understand why is somebody anemic. And I think if there's one blood test to focus on, it's the ferritin. And ferritin by itself can itself be used as a screening test to determine anemia or certainly iron deficiency in a patient with IBD or really any patient. Ferritin will be low in states of iron deficiency. We typically talk about a ferritin lower than 30 as being the threshold for a definition of iron deficiency. And a ferritin of greater than 100 in the setting of anemia would be consistent with anemia of chronic disease. There is a gray zone of a ferritin between 30 and 100, and I think that's also relevant in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, because in addition to being a transport protein for iron, ferritin is also an acute phase reactant that may go up in states of inflammation. So a patient with inflammatory bowel disease may have a ferritin higher than 30, even in a state of severe iron deficiency, because more of that ferritin is being produced in that state of inflammation.
So the acute phase reactant ferritin can actually be elevated even when they are iron deficient.
Exactly right. And that's why I think using an absolute cutoff of 30 may lead us to miss some cases of iron deficiency, because that acute phase reactant may lead to that ferritin being elevated despite a state of severe iron deficiency.
Okay. So let's move on. Now, one of the things that you do, in addition to all your other titles at CDRS, is that you're one of our national leaders of something called IBD Chorus, which is the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation's effort to improve the quality of care. And you and Corey Siegel have been just phenomenal leaders of that initiative. One of the things that you did with the foundation and through Chorus was to develop an anemia care pathway, and we're really delighted to share with the audience tonight. Can you take us through this?
Sure. And I will also say that this is available online. If you just Google anemia care pathway, you should be able to find it and download it to have it available, which puts its algorithm in a broader context, not just chopped up in the slides that I'm going to walk through. So basically what the concept is that we encounter and see anemia or iron deficiency on a regular basis, but what do we actually do? How do we think about it? And what are the steps that would make sense in following an algorithm for ideally and optimally managing these patients? And what I'm going to talk about is essentially a consensus, if you will, with multi-stakeholder input, including experts in anemia, for how to think about anemia in our patients, specifically with inflammatory bowel disease. And it starts with either patients presenting symptomatically with fatigue, which is a common symptom that our patients with IBD may have, which is often associated, not always, but often associated with anemia, or somebody perhaps who may present with bleeding or may have ongoing bleeding, or using ferritin as that universal test, which I mentioned earlier. Again, if there's one test you're going to look to do in order to screen for iron deficiency anemia, that would be the ferritin. So any of those could lead to the recognition of anemia or iron deficiency, or perhaps non-anemic iron deficiency, which itself may also be associated with symptoms, for example, like fatigue. So you could have, following down on the right side of the screen, recognition of a non-anemic iron deficiency. Somebody who's iron deficient but not yet anemic can still be affected by that with symptoms, for example, of fatigue. And so that's when the ferritin by itself can be very helpful and probably should be repleted when that ferritin is low, especially in a symptomatic patient.
Yeah, I often bring up that the life cycle of red blood cells is 90 days. So if you see this and those red cells go through their life cycle, you may end up anemic if you haven't addressed it in some way. All right, so continue on down the pathway for us.
Well, so then if you haven't checked the ferritin, it's checking the ferritin for iron stores. And we can also use the transferrin saturation in order to give us a sense of the iron stores of a patient. Low transferrin saturation means that those transferrin receptors, which are transporting iron, are empty. They're not being used. And certainly a cutoff of 20% is looked at. But we actually don't need the transferrin saturation. A ferritin by itself may be good enough. And at that point, we're going to think about the patient, what's the best way to replete their iron? Because they are somebody who does need iron repletion when they've got inadequate iron stores. And at this point, there's a fork in the road. We really have to think as clinicians, what is the best way to treat this iron deficiency? Is it giving somebody oral iron, or is it giving somebody intravenous iron, or referral perhaps to a hematology colleague? And at this point, the consideration of the activity of the IBD is very important. I mentioned before, and we're going to have a cartoon of this coming up, the regulation of iron can and is influenced by the state of inflammation. So when somebody has active IBD, they are simply unable to absorb iron in a way that allows their body to use it. Whereas when somebody has inactive IBD, they certainly may be able to absorb that oral iron. And so that's an important consideration when thinking about the most appropriate way to replete iron. For individuals who do not have iron deficiency, that could be picked up also on a ferritin. A very high ferritin, for example, in that middle red box, is a state of iron overload, and that's a condition for which further evaluation would be appropriate in the hands of a hematologist. And then there are many other causes of iron deficiency or anemia, despite iron levels that may be in the normal range, where workup for example, vitamin B12 deficiency, folate deficiency, or perhaps medication-associated anemia, some of which we can identify as gastroenterologists and some of which we may look to our hematology colleagues for assistance in that diagnosis.
Or even the mixed picture where we, for example, know that thiopurines might increase your MCV. So assessing the iron stores in the setting of what looks like a medication-induced macrocytosis can be a very important part of the evaluation and workup. Teach us about Hepcidin and how can we use this as a way to assess further?
Yeah, so I think this Hepcidin or Hepcidin, as some call it, is considered a master regulator of iron metabolism. And, you know, this was not something that we talked about when I was in medical school. It's a relatively newer discovery, but I think one that has really influenced how we think about the appropriate ways of management of iron deficiency. So Hepcidin is a protein that's produced in the liver, and we'll start with the cartoon on the left. You could see those little red dots that are in the liver are produced at a certain rate. And the role of Hepcidin or Hepcidin is to control what happens to iron after it has been absorbed into the enterocyte. So that enterocyte cell may have iron that comes across the brush border at the top. For example, if you're eating an iron-rich meal or taking an oral iron supplementation, and that iron goes into the enterocyte. The iron then needs to exit the enterocyte, right? It gets absorbed, but then it's got to get into the bloodstream. How does it get into the bloodstream? Well, we have a regulating protein called ferroportin. That's that green protein that regulates how iron exits the cell. What Hepcidin does is Hepcidin regulates ferroportin. So when Hepcidin is produced in high amounts, ferroportin actually gets degraded inside the cell and iron gets trapped in the enterocyte and is unable to exit. So in states of inflammation, so on the cartoon on the right, where Hepcidin is overexpressed. And Hepcidin is one of these liver protein that's also an acute phase reactant. Hepcidin correlates very nicely with C-reactive protein, CRP, which is, as we all know, elevated in states of inflammation. So when you have a state of inflammation, you also have upregulation and overexpression of Hepcidin. When Hepcidin is upregulated, then ferroportin is degraded, and the iron has no way of exiting the enterocyte. So you can take in all the oral iron that you want. It's going to get stuck in the enterocyte. It's not going to get into the bloodstream where it can have its erythropoietic effects downstream. And so this is one way I think that we can really understand why it is that with states of inflammation, patients are simply unable to absorb all the oral iron that we may give them. And that's when we need to be thinking about a different strategy, i.e. IV iron formulation.
Gil, that was the best explanation of this that I have ever heard. Thank you so much. I hope everyone at home is getting this as well. I really appreciate it. So what do we do in follow-up? One of the challenges we often have is after we have identified this, how often do we recheck? When do we check after we've started someone on oral iron or when we've given IV iron? When do we do all the next steps?
Right. So, David, I think that's really even asking the question is something that I think is often overlooked, is when do you do the follow-up? I think many times we don't do the follow-up. And so one component, or really a really critical component of our care pathway is that there is a follow-up. When should that follow-up be? The experts tell us at about 4 weeks. If we're going to be repleting iron to influence hemoglobin in somebody that's anemic, we'd like to see a response in hemoglobin by 2 grams per deciliter. That's actually an outcome that's used in many of the clinical trials, which enroll patients with hemoglobins less than 10. So that's looked at it as a clinical trial, and I think it's a potentially relevant endpoint in clinical practice, is looking for a hemoglobin increase of 2 grams per deciliter at 4 weeks. If somebody has not achieved that, then we got to try something different. If they've been getting oral iron, at that point, consider an IV iron formulation. If you're getting IV iron and they're not bumping their hemoglobin, they're not bumping their iron, something else is going on. It's time to get a hematologist involved. If somebody does respond, then at that point they go into sort of maintenance mode. We can make sure that they're responding appropriately, that they do have longer term maintenance of those iron and hemoglobin levels. And if they do, then go back to those symptoms. If they presented with fatigue, is that something that has been corrected? And if that fatigue has been corrected by repletion of the iron, that's great. But if not, then we obviously need to continue to search for causes of fatigue, because as we know, that itself is a symptom that can be multifactorial. So even though that fatigue may have triggered this iron repletion, it certainly could be caused by other factors.
And I know many of our colleagues out there might be thinking, is this something that I should own, or is this something that I might do in collaboration with the primary care physicians? I'm actually thinking this care pathway is something I would print and give to my nursing team. There's lots of ways that this could be incorporated into everyone's practices, and I'm sure there are different models for that. All right, yes, well, Gil, that was terrific. Can you tell us a little bit about available iron formulations? And then we'll move on to our final learning objective.
Yes, so this slide is really to indicate that there are different formulations. I think that many of us may pick one that we're comfortable with in terms of dosing, but there are multiple different iron, oral iron formulations. And I do want to call attention to the last one on the list. That's ferric maltol, which is newly approved by the FDA. And notice that's ferric, not ferrous, like many of the others that are listed there. So this is actually not a salt, and based on its binding, it has a different absorption mechanism and thought to perhaps be an oral iron formulation that is not associated with many of the GI side effects that the other salt-based iron formulations have been associated with. So this is literally just approved in the last few months by the FDA. I think this will be an interesting oral option for our patients, and it'll be interesting to see how that turns out in clinical practice. On the right side of the screen are the various parenteral iron formulations. These are all of really available to us at this point. And I think that, you know, certainly we have to understand some of the differences between them. Some of them do warrant test doses in order to make sure patients don't have reactions to them. Others require greater or fewer numbers of infusions in order to replete iron. So it does behoove us to understand some of the details, all of which can be found in a synopsis of that anemia care pathway in order to help guide specific dosing of these formulations.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much, Gil. So our key takeaways from our discussion tonight about anemia in IBD, and I've actually learned a bunch from Gil, is the importance of screening for iron deficiency. When people are in remission, we should still be checking blood count and keeping an eye on this. When they have active disease, it needs to be done more frequently, because you've learned tonight that there may be multiple different reasons that people are either malabsorbing or unable to effectively use iron stores and address their anemia. So very important. I would refer you all to the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation's Anemia Care Pathway, which is available on the internet. And I would also remind you, and this I think is obvious but very important, in order to address anemia and in order to fully address iron deficiency, we also have to effectively treat the IBD. So I'm going to move on to our final learning objective. It's a shorter one, but it's a very important one. This learning objective is to select treatments for patients with the understanding that there are disease factors, patient factors, provider factors, and payer factors, and there's a lot of issues here. We're going to focus a bit more on patient preferences. And I want to start by reminding you one of the major advances in our field is the distinction between disease activity, which is how sick a patient is right now, and it has elements of how inflamed they are and other comorbid factors, and disease severity, which is really focused on prognosis and has to do with the likelihood of poor outcomes if the disease isn't managed properly. Our choices of therapies, as I summarized in the first slide tonight, are based on some of these factors. What do we need to get someone into remission, and what are we going to need to keep them well in a maintenance phase that prevents relapse? Now, when we talk to patients about choosing therapies, in addition to the challenges we have in knowing which treatments to pick, we also have to acknowledge that there are a variety of patient factors that weigh into the decision making. This includes the patient's need for the therapy in the first place and understanding our goals of management, but also includes individual patient preferences, tolerability and convenience factors related to the patient's proximity to the doctor's office or an infusion center or their job if they're traveling more and they need therapies that can be more mobile, as well as economic resources like whether a payer is going to let them have the therapy or whether they can afford the co-pays related to the therapy. We certainly know that patients want to be involved in their decision making. In this survey of over 1,000 Dutch patients with IBD, most of them said that it was very important that they be involved in treatment decision making. Not a surprise to anyone who lives in the United States and takes care of our patients who value their autonomy in decision making. It was a very small number who said it was totally unimportant to be involved. When we asked our patients about what they think, of course, there were many answers, but this is a representative audio clip that we thought would be instructive.
Well, the doctor I have now is very engaged with my symptoms, treatment plans, and anything that I want to discuss about IBD. My doctor that I had in the past, I felt wasn't someone that really understood what was going on with my body.
So you hear from this patient that she actually had multiple physicians previously, and the one she has now is listening to her. And we certainly recognize the challenge of doing that and also making our patients feel heard. So when we talk about the spectrum of patient-provider communication, we can go all the way to left where we talk about more paternalism, where we make decisions and just recommend them to patients and implement them, and all the way on the right, which is mostly autonomous decision-making, or some call it consumerism, although I don't like that term that much. Somewhere in the middle is where we want to be with most patients. I would actually add the additional dimension to this, that the sicker somebody is, the less of this conversation we may actually have. We need to get them well. And the more we're into chronic phase of management, whether they're in remission or not, the more patients are tolerating their care and their therapy, and the more we're talking about long-term is when we really get into shared decision-making even more. Nonetheless, there are some recommendations about how we can do this and how it might improve adherence to therapy. So how can that be? Well, certainly if patients participate in the decision-making, they're more likely to stay on the therapy that they have had a part in deciding. And I'll add that once they start responding to a new therapy, they're more likely to stay on the therapy and have a favorable impression of the risk-to-benefit ratio. We know that patients are not always adherent to therapy. It's human nature, especially when they start to feel well. And the number of pills, the number of times they have to take the therapy, and a variety of other delivery systems can all impact adherence. We also recognize that patients who are not adherent are more likely to relapse, are more likely to have significant and poor outcomes like hospitalization or even surgeries from their disease. So addressing this in a conversation with patients and understanding their needs is very important. Of course, all of you experienced clinicians out there are wondering, how do we do this with the time we have with patients and given the complexity of the disease? And I completely agree with you. Well, I would start by saying go to reliable resources like the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation's website and ultimately the GI Hub of CMEOutfitters.com to use information and tools that can help patients understand what we're recommending. There are a variety of other strategies that have been suggested, like focusing on now and not getting too far ahead of yourself in terms of the long-term management of the disease. Listening to what patients say is their goal of their management, so that we can be on the same page about our expectations and our plans. Asking situational questions like, what is the plan for this therapy and what would you like to get back in your life that you're not able to do now? Providing the valuable information patients need, as well as scheduling second and third appointments to have an ongoing dialogue. For these conditions, we often don't need to do everything all at once. We can schedule follow-up and continue the conversation. And of course, incorporating all of our team members in this conversation, working together with the wonderful team members we have, whether it's our nurse associates, our advanced practice providers, our dietitians, our psychologists, our social workers, whatever you have as part of your practice may come into play in incorporating a much bigger dynamic of shared decision making. And I think finally, focusing on goals is a very important part of this. So I want to thank you for joining us, and now we're getting to the fun part, which will be to address some of your questions tonight. And I'm going to summarize what we've covered, which has been a broad spectrum of IBD care, and I hope some new information for all of you. First, we've talked about the new therapies, the JAK inhibitors, and our SMART goal has been to recognize the safety and efficacy data for the available JAK inhibitors in IBD, and at the current time, the one that's currently approved and available for ulcerative colitis, tofacitinib. We've talked to you about the importance of screening, recognizing, and treating iron deficiency and understanding the multiple mechanisms of anemia and how critical it is to manage IBD while thinking about these factors as well. And lastly, we talked a bit about the importance of developing these shared decision-making models, which I know in your practice you are doing, but we can always improve in the way we interact with our patients and incorporate some of this new information so that they're part of our plan for their chronic management. So for additional resources, I would refer you to the CMEOutfitters.com website and the GI Hub. I want to thank you all for joining us and also refer you to the additional comprehensive list of clinical resources on this website. And now we'd like to open things up for your questions. All right, well, welcome back, everyone. We're excited to have a conversation now with some of the questions that have come in from our audience at home. I'm gonna actually start off with one for Jamie. Jamie, how are you getting herpes zoster vaccinations for your people under age 50?
We've had, I mean, I think in general, we've had challenges of getting it for any age because of the national shortage. I do have my patients put themselves on a wait list with both their primary care physicians and then multiple other potential clinics also give this. But I actually haven't run into too many problems if we're using the CDC website literature, using the fact that the patient is starting immunosuppression, the fact that this particular therapy increases the risk of herpes zoster. And we haven't run into too many significant problems. The out-of-pocket cost depends on really the state you live in, but can be anywhere from a couple hundred dollars to $300-$400 per dose, and it's a two-dose vaccination. So we haven't really run into too many issues with coverage in our younger patients, but I have heard from colleagues nationally that that has been a problem.
I have a couple of practical recommendations related to this. One of them is that the first thing to know is that you can give the shingles vaccine after you've started therapy with TOFA. So the attenuated vaccination can be given later. The risk of zoster in the TOFA studies was only 1% during induction and went up to about 4%, but was stable, as you saw on the slide, over the subsequent maintenance period. So although there's a shortage and sometimes it takes time, you should be treating their IBD and then get them the vaccination a little bit later. We've actually been storing it and stocking it in our clinic and providing it to patients there, but I recognize there's a challenge all over. Gil, I'm going to actually ask you a question about severe ulcerative colitis. Have you had any occasion to use tofacitinib for hospitalized patients?
We've thought about using it, but we haven't actually given it in the hospital. With studies going on, such as at University of Michigan, with really high doses of tofacitinib, I think that may be something that will be an interesting way of using tofacitinib for induction. But we've really had challenges in getting it quickly, which is, I think, the kind of scenario where we would like to in a hospitalized patient. I'm curious if either of you have done it, and I know Jamie being there.
Well, Jamie's at U of M, so let me ask. I know that your colleague Peter Higgins has studied this a bit. What are you guys doing now?
We published a very small case series of patients last year in CGH looking at the inpatient use, looking at higher doses. If you remember in the phase two studies, they did look at 15 milligrams twice daily, and the dosing that we have used, and it is off-label, obviously in the inpatient setting, in what was published was 10 milligrams three times a day. What we worked very closely to partner with our pharmacist to get this on our formulary so that we have access to it in the inpatient setting. Other places that I've used it as some off-site hospitals where we can get outpatient samples and bring them into the inpatient setting, which has given us the ability to do it in other clinical settings outside of the University of Michigan.
I think that the possibility of using a small molecule like TOFA in severe UC is attractive. The reality is that we have to understand that using higher than labeled dosing, especially now that we've learned about some of the other concerns of safety, is not recommended. So I think using it at standard dosing in the hospitalized patient population is still of great interest, and we clearly need to do more there.
Yeah, and we're studying it in a clinical trial, so that's where we're using it in a higher dose, but currently using it at standard dosing at the 10 milligrams twice daily and having some considerable success in some refractory patients.
If I can chime in,
yeah.
Can you hear me?
Of course.
I just want to underscore your point, David, and I think that the safety concerns that have been raised, you talked about zoster, you talked about the thromboembolic risk, both of those are dose-dependent risks. So certainly in using higher than labeled doses, but even at the 10 BID labeled dose in that hospitalized sick UC patient who's probably also on IV steroids, we already know that these patients are at the highest risk for thromboembolic events. Does really require us to think about that safety paramount and with appropriate informed consent, such as being done in a clinical trial.
Thank you. All right, Gil, there's a few questions about iron deficiency, and I'd really appreciate your insight. One of them is about your approach to iron deficiency in a menstruating female. So in other words, how do you handle it differently, or is it exactly the same as what we talked about? Do you monitor them more frequently? Do you work in conjunction with their gynecologist in this regard, or what are your different approaches?
Yeah, I don't necessarily have a different approach. I think a menstruating female with heavy menses will typically have a known history of anemia that she will already know has been ascribed to her menstruation. And so that's a scenario which a woman is probably already aware of and may already be on chronic iron therapy for. I think that we do need to consider the fact that women who are menstruating are at increased risk for iron deficiency and anemia in the setting of IBD, but I would manage them the same way. Typically with all, if somebody with inactive IBD could be a woman who could be managed on oral iron therapy alone.
Very good. Gil, there's some additional questions here about how do you choose which iron formulation to use, whether it's oral or IV. Is this predominantly based on payers? Do you always start with oral and then give them IV? Can you give us a little bit of guidance here?
Well, I think looking to the care pathway, we do have some guidance. If somebody's got active inflammatory bowel disease, and I think, you know, with significant activity that I think we can ascribe to as the cause for the iron deficiency anemia, that's somebody who I probably would start with IV iron without even bothering with oral iron. That's somebody who I can already predict is likely not going to respond to oral iron, will probably or very likely have intolerance to the oral iron. And so we're just going to lose time and ground and get a grumpy patient because I've given them abdominal distress on top of other symptoms already. So that's probably somebody I'll start directly with IV iron. Also, somebody with a significant anemia, you know, not waste time with oral iron, even if their IBD may not be necessarily that active. But with somebody without a significant anemia, it doesn't look like we've got risk of time. Certainly, we could wait a month in a trial of oral iron. I think that's totally reasonable. The question then becomes about which IV iron preparation. I think some of that is going to be formulary specific. We are restricted in the types of iron that we can give parenterally. And so I think that may be specific to the payer mix or the particular contracts that your institution or that your hematologist may work with. But I tend to favor the IV iron formulations that allow us to give more iron in fewer doses. So for example, ferrocarboxymaltose, we can give 750 milligrams over two doses. We can replete somebody pretty much completely with two doses of iron, as opposed to iron sucrose, for example, which may take five doses of 200 milligrams each.
Just to stick with you and on this general topic, a couple of our viewers have asked, what should be the quality measures that we're currently using for IBD, and is anemia one of them, and how do we incorporate that into our practice? So maybe you can give us a little background on the IBD Chorus initiative and what is currently recommended.
Sure. So, the IBD Chorus initiative is a multi-center nationwide effort to improve quality in IBD, going on right now at 40 different IBD practices around the country and looking for more practices to join. So certainly a plug for that if anyone's interested. They could contact the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. But really what the effort is intended to do is to look at the quality measures that have been out there. And there's many different quality measures. One of the original quality measure sets did include anemia as a quality metric, but others include things that we all, I think about typically, the use of steroids, a patient being in clinical remission, symptoms such as nocturnal bowel movements or incontinence, time off from work or school, emergency room visits, hospitalizations. Some of these things are easier to measure and some of them are more tricky to measure. I think when we talk about quality improvement for IBD specifically, we're not trying to check off boxes at this point in time to fulfill a government mandate. I think that's much easier done with other disease states. With inflammatory bowel disease, I think we really want to overall just improve the quality of care that we're able to deliver. And so to whoever's asking the question, I think the answer is going to depend on what are you able to measure, because when it comes to quality improvement, pick one thing that you can measure. If it's anemia, the proportion of patients in your practice with anemia, or if it's steroid use, or if it's giving the zoster vaccine to patients who meet the criteria that you're going to set, whatever that's going to be, to be able to measure it and then follow it over time to know whether your efforts are actually leading to improvement.
That's great. Well, thank you again for your leadership on all of those initiatives for us. Jamie, I'm going to ask you a couple questions here. One of them has to do with whether or not upadacitinib, filgotinib, or tofacitinib are actually looking at histology as an endpoint. So we've seen that with ustekinumab. Is that something that some of these other therapies are starting to look at, and are you incorporating that at all in your practice yet?
I think that's a little bit more challenging question. I'd have to go back to the clinical trials to look at all the endpoints. They had quite a few primary endpoints and then many secondary endpoints. I think mucosal healing, what they're defining as the evidence of mucosal healing, is looking at histologic inflammation and whether that's a hard endpoint we should be achieving. I don't know that we're there yet in terms of making that blanket statement. I think in the clinical trials, you know, achieving a Mayo 0 or Mayo 1 score endoscopically, I think, is a really good goal. We know that patients that have persistent histologic inflammation are more likely to have clinical relapse over time. And so if we can get there, that's great. Whether or not I would switch out of class in someone who has achieved a Mayo score of 1 with significant improvement in their quality of life and clinical measures, I don't know that the data supports that yet.
Okay, well, I agree with that. It's certainly not an endpoint that we're treating towards yet, but it is of interest both from the FDA and for the rest of us. We certainly recognize histology may be a predictive variable in management, but we don't know yet that it's better than endoscopy, so there'll be more coming as we learn more about ustekinumab and some of these novel therapies that are exploring these endpoints. So there are a few questions here about whether patients have to actually be on an anti-TNF therapy and not respond, or could they have just been exposed to an anti-TNF therapy previously before they get tofacitinib? What's the clarification?
I think that the way that the label reads is exposure to anti-TNF. Right. You can define failure of a therapy in many ways. Somebody can have, you know, lack of clinical response, or you could then define it as lack of mucosal healing or histologic response.
Sure.
On both spectrums. So I think that the way that the label reads, and appropriately so, given some of the more recent safety concerns, is that the patients have to be exposed to an anti-TNF and quote, fail an anti-TNF. So if a patient was able to achieve a remission state, whether you define that clinically or endoscopically, on an anti-TNF, that would not be a patient that I would take off that therapy unless they had a contraindication for that anti-TNF or side effects related to the anti-TNF, or a clear indication to initiate tofacitinib for a co-diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis that wasn't necessarily responding to the anti-TNF than necessarily the primary IBD itself.
Okay. Gil, you have a patient on anti-TNF therapy and they're not responding and they have ulcerative colitis and you'd like to start them on tofacitinib. Do you do a washout? Do you measure a drug level? How are you managing this?
I personally do not do a washout. I would not hesitate to start it. Typically, if I'm thinking that's probably going to be better than a steroid bridge, so I'm going to want to get them on it as quickly as I can. And I wouldn't check a level for that purpose. I might check a level to make sure that that's the right move to move out of class. But once I've made that decision, I personally would not hesitate to just start it.
Yeah, in my own practice, I'm doing the same, which is that by the time insurance approves the therapy, there's usually a short period of time where we're in between, but we move pretty quickly right to the new therapy. And of course, we have a conversation with the patient. What we don't want to do necessarily is intentionally stack our immunosuppression. We have to recognize that although tofacitinib is oral, which is convenient, it is a pretty potent therapy. In fact, we know that it works fast when it works. Which means it's actually doing its job very quickly. So I agree completely with you in that approach. Jamie, there's a number of questions about access. Our colleagues out there in the trenches are really struggling with getting patients therapies. Tell us a little bit about how your practice is getting therapies approved through payers, and then I'll share my model, and then we'll ask Gil how his team does it.
Well, we've taken a lot of lead from University of Chicago and your IBD specialty pharmacist in terms of trying to get therapies approved. I think as long as you're prescribing on the label, and so very clearly following that, there's evidence to support use. We have the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation has several resources in terms of appeal letters when denial of therapy happens to help support both the physicians in the community as well as patients in terms of appealing various decisions. But some of the newer therapies, more recently tofacitinib and then ustekinumab, that's approved for ulcerative colitis, if we're focusing on ulcerative colitis, have been challenging to get because they are newer therapies. And so that has been a challenge for us in Michigan. Some states have better support mechanisms in place in terms of bridge programs to get patients on therapy or get drug for the first year. Some states do not, and Michigan is one of those states that does not have that option. So we've had more challenges, I think, in Michigan than most.
I mean, it's clearly a national crisis. That's why all of our political candidates are having conversations about some of these topics. Gil, what are you guys doing out in Los Angeles to get your patients their treatments?
Yeah, we certainly struggle with these issues as well. I think that I've learned as a clinician that I also have a role to play. It's not simply I choose with the patient what treatment we should go on and then wait and be in a reactive mode, but rather, just like everything else we're moving toward in IBD, I think I'm taking a much more proactive mode at this point. What do I mean by that? Well, there's, you know, getting all our ducks in a row, making sure that I've got documented in my note, what is the indication for the drug? What are the drugs that the patient has previously tried and failed? What was the date of their last TB test or hepatitis B serologies that may be relevant to the medication that I'm about to prescribe? And that enables my team to then not have that back and forth with me or them digging through the charts or them having the back and forth with the payer who was then asking for that information that ends up delaying things. So for me as the provider, it's a little bit more intentional and proactive on my part to get those ducks in a row in my note when I'm seeing the patient. And then passing it off to my team. But frankly, my team has needed to grow because of the additional administrative burden of getting these drugs approved.
Yeah, completely agree, Gil. In our practice, there's a few things that we've put in place. One is exactly what you said, which is that we've been trained by our amazing specialty pharmacy team led by Shivani Patel to make sure that we have all the pieces of information in our note when we're recommending the therapy. And in fact, in all of our clinic exam rooms, she's put up a little chart of what labs to order for each therapy we're considering and the additional pieces of information that will need to be in the note, because you don't want to miss something that's really easy that's going to end up delaying approvals. The second thing I completely agree as well is that we stay involved and we try to help our team, although we're fortunate to have some people working on it. I know many people out there are not blessed with their own specialty pharmacy. So we also do partner with a third-party specialty pharmacy that takes some of the burden off of us because they benefit too. So they'll work on approval for some of the infusion-based therapies. And lastly, of course, we try to advocate on behalf of our patients, but as I think many out there know, a true peer-to-peer is not really happening very much anymore. First, because you rarely will talk to a colleague who's a gastroenterologist that's up on IBD. But also, even when you do get a physician peer on the phone, they often say, I'm unable to approve this. I can only tell you how to appeal in writing. So we're facing some real challenges with our patients. In the meantime, we have to take it one patient, one day at a time, and continue to advocate as much as we can. All right, with that topic, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. There's some great questions here also about some general management principles, and I thought we could talk about that as a group. So, Gil, let's start with you. When you start a patient on a new therapy for ulcerative colitis, when do you perform endoscopy or some other assessment to know whether or not the therapy is working?
Yeah, that's a great question that I think certainly has evolved in my practice over time. When I'm starting somebody on a new therapy with ulcerative colitis, typically I'm going to have them come back in 2 to 4 weeks to see my nurse practitioner. And just with a check-in, are they getting better and are they having any associated side effects to the new therapy? You know, that time frame, that time horizon may differ depending on the severity of where they're at the time they're starting the medication. Sometimes we'll ask them to come in a week. Sometimes we'll be comfortable waiting a little bit longer. I will typically want to see them myself at 2 to 3 months out. And then at that point, plan an endoscopic evaluation, either a sigmoidoscopy or colonoscopy. Usually, not always, but almost always, I will try to do some kind of endoscopic evaluation 4 to 6 months out after starting a new therapy, but with that approximate 3-month evaluation.
I think that the question that's being asked and your answer really reflect how the field has moved forward and how we're now combining the important clinical management from a symptom point of view, partnered with objective disease control. And as Jamie presented in the data from some of the clinical trials, mucosal healing or endoscopic improvement, and more recently the histoendoscopic mucosal improvement, are all endpoints of interest that show us that we're controlling the disease as much as we're improving symptoms. You should have one first and then the other. In my own practice, when I started therapy, it's very similar to what you said, Gil. I'm reassessing the disease process itself at about 6 to 8 weeks, either with a calprotectin or, if they make it, a CRP or some other objective measure, in addition to knowing that their symptoms are improving. And obviously, I warn patients that they shouldn't be getting worse while they're waiting. Jamie, are you using calprotectin in Michigan?
We use fecal calprotectin quite often and actually have just developed a near point of care, same day turnaround on our fecal calprotectin at the university. So it's actually been really helpful to see a patient in the morning and have a fecal calprotectin by the afternoon to help guide us, especially those patients that have persistent symptoms but no clear signs of objective inflammation. It really helps us decide what we should do next in real time.
Sure. So point of care calprotectin testing is of great interest, of course. The great irony of everyone who's a gastroenterologist is patients can never go to the bathroom when you ask them to.
Yep.
It's all the times when they're not in our clinics that they're, of course, suffering. But that obviously is very important. So is the future availability of an at-home test. So we'll be moving into some of these more objective measures that we can incorporate into practice.
Yep.
There are a few questions about therapeutic drug monitoring as a way to know whether therapies work. Let me start with the one about JAK inhibitors. Jamie, do we need to check levels of tofacitinib or any of these other therapies?
Currently, right now, we have no data that would support checking levels or ability to do that in sort of a commercial way.
And it doesn't seem like it might be needed as much. And part of the reason for that, we hope, is the same reason that our rheumatology colleagues don't really order them very often for our monoclonal antibodies, which is that when you have a drug that's getting absorbed with a high affinity in the small bowel, you know how much drug the patient's getting. You don't worry so much about clearance the same way as we do with protein-based therapies, which might be leaking in the bowel. So I'm actually speaking at the American College of Rheumatology meeting next week, and I'm going to be talking to them about the difference between rheumatology and GI, where we have to think a little bit more about some of those challenges. So no therapeutic drug monitoring for the JAKs right now. Great. How about for our monoclonal antibodies? Gil, you're at one of the places that's really pioneered some of this. Are you doing post-loading drug levels, or do you just do it as a reactive model in patients losing response?
I'm pretty much advocating for exactly as you described it, post-loading drug levels, which is getting a drug concentration early on after starting someone on biologic therapy. I think some of the best models that we have for prediction for how somebody's going to do later on are reflected in how well we're able to achieve adequate drug concentration earlier on before they end up in trouble. So I am taking a more proactive approach earlier on, and you might ask me when it's early. I think that that probably is going to depend on the specific drug. But by infliximab, certainly by their third infusion, I'm getting a trough concentration.
And we certainly know that those levels might predict likelihood of still responding to therapy by the end of the first year.
Terrific. Exactly.
All right. There's a topic that came up in the questions that we didn't talk about tonight, but it's so important that I'm actually going to ask my two colleagues here. It has to do with pain management in IBD. So maybe you can describe for us your approach to managing pain in your patients with Crohn's disease or colitis. Do you have a team? Is it more of a system-based approach? Can you share with us how you individually are doing this or what your practices are doing? It's such an important issue, and of course we have other challenges nationally with opioids, et cetera. So what are you doing? Jamie?
Absolutely. So I think it depends on where the patient has pain. So I'm thinking, given the nature of these conditions, we're probably speaking more about abdominal discomfort or persistence of abdominal pain. And I think what's more important is identifying what's driving that symptom. So is this active inflammation that really needs to be better treated with anti-inflammatories? Or is this a manifestation of chronic long-standing inflammation in Crohn's disease, a patient with stricture. In patients that have slower gut motility, is this bacterial overgrowth that's leading to pain. I think really identifying the cause of the pain, alternatively then just throwing a pain medication at these patients, which we don't do in routine practice, and really have advised against narcotic use because of data that clearly shows worse outcomes in patients who are using narcotics, increased hospitalizations, increased healthcare utilization than compared to the general population.
What about medical marijuana to address pain and avoid opioid use? There are some data now to suggest that might be helpful.
The data that does exist and supports the use of medical marijuana in IBD has really focused on those more subjective complaints of improvement in pain, improvement in diarrhea, improvement in appetite and nausea. So I think that the what we know about safety in medical cannabis and what we know about safety in chronic narcotic use, I think that if we can partner with our patients to find a better route to manage pain, including potentially the use of medical cannabis.
Yeah. Gil, tell us about your approach to pain in the Cedars-Sinai Clinic for IBD.
Yes, I agree with everything Jamie said. I you know, without necessarily repeating it all, I think that it's really critical to try to get an understanding of it and then offer non-opioid options for patients that do need management of their chronic pain. The only thing I'll add is that sometimes we will benefit from having a pain specialist involved because sometimes patients are either on opioids or may benefit from opioids under the strict management of a pain specialist with appropriate contracts with the patient, et cetera. We actually just looked at our own experience in our inpatients, our hospitalized patients' management of their pain, because certainly pain is much more acute in hospitalized patients. And what we found was if you looked at the patients who were treated with opiates in the hospital, their pain actually didn't even get better. It was marginally better than those that were managed with non-opioid options. So we're looking very, very carefully at different ways of optimizing pain management, both as outpatients and as inpatients, through some creative mechanisms in order to avoid prescribing opiates, because the greatest predictor of being addicted to opiates is getting a prescription for one upon your discharge from the hospital.
That's great. Thank you so much, Gil. I've been incorporating a variety of things, and I know colleagues of ours who are also studying and working with some really phenomenal GI psychologists as well to focus on hypnotherapy as an adjuvant approach, and also just educating both ourselves and our patients about different causes of pain related to IBD. It's a very challenging problem and one that we need to get our hands around. I guess I could then put in my own plug to ask everyone to consider coming to the Crohn's and Colitis Congress in January, which will be in Austin, Texas. This is put on by the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation with the AGA, and there'll be a number of multidisciplinary panels discussing some of the challenges we face in managing such things as pain and multidisciplinary approaches to anxiety and depression related to IBD as well. So obviously very, very important. Gil, there are a few questions about cost of iron therapies. I don't know if you can address those or if you've had trouble getting certain things approved, either oral or IV, but any pointers you want to share with us?
I think just like with our biologic therapies, many payers are now requiring either authorizations or prior approvals, or have tiered approaches to how they're paying, how they're approaching their payment for parenteral formulations of iron. So I think it's really important to also, just like with biologics, we're forced to understand how that process works. Also to not make assumptions about IV iron, because IV iron can be very expensive if the insurance doesn't cover it. Both in terms of the drug itself and in terms of the infusion costs. So it does behoove us as practitioners to do due diligence and make sure we're prescribing something that's on formula.
That's great, Gil. We appreciate it very much. So a few more questions and then we're going to wrap. The time went by really fast. I want to thank everyone again for joining us. Let me try to address a few quickly myself that have just come in. There's a couple people who want to see the chart we have in our clinic exam rooms. And I'm delighted to share that with you. I also know that Shivani Patel, who developed that and is an associate director of our IBD Center, is writing a paper summarizing some of these efforts. But I will take a picture of it and I will tweet it out. So if you're following me on Twitter, that'll be coming in the next few days. I'm in clinic Wednesday and Friday this week. I would also answer a question somebody had here related to just clarifying the mechanism of ustekinumab compared to tofa and infliximab. Let me just summarize that one more time. Ustekinumab is a monoclonal antibody that targets a protein that is on two cytokines, IL-12 and IL-23. So when you give ustekinumab therapy for Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, it actually inhibits those two cytokines and is dosed IV for loading and then sub-Q in maintenance phase. Tofacitinib, of course, we've talked a lot about tonight, is an oral small molecule. It's a JAK inhibitor. And of course, our old friend infliximab was the first drug approved by the FDA for Crohn's disease and is, of course, available as well for ulcerative colitis and perianal Crohn's disease. It's a monoclonal antibody targeting TNF. So hopefully I've clarified that for some of those out there who are trying to just get their hands around all these different therapies. We've had a couple other questions that I'm going to address and I'm going to ask Jamie to clarify for us. Any data on biological therapies for pregnancy? What should people know about that? And maybe you can expand that and mention anything we should know about tofacitinib in pregnancy.
Absolutely. I think that we have lots of data through the PIANA registry. And I think I'd like to call attention to the AGA pregnancy care pathway, which has been a wonderful addition to the literature to help guide both, you know, IBD clinicians like myself, as well as the community clinicians taking care of pregnant patients with inflammatory bowel disease. So I'll refer that you to there because that really highlights all mechanisms, although it does not bring up tofacitinib as it was published and put together prior to tofacitinib coming out for ulcerative colitis. Right now, I believe that the PIANA registry is enrolling patients that are exposed. However, I do know that we have avoided this using this in patients who are actively trying to get pregnant. And in patients who have achieved remission but plan for pregnancy, have discussed alternative mechanisms that we have more data on in terms of safety. We really do have limited data, as most of the data that we have long-term is in rheumatoid arthritis patients. And as you know, they're an older population than our inflammatory bowel disease patients, so we don't have a ton of exposures and data to follow on tofacitinib.
Okay, so the AGA care pathway for those who are planning to have children and planning their families is a very useful resource for biological therapies. For the most part, the recommendation has been to stay on therapies and not change your dosing schedules so that patients stay in remission through their pregnancy. And with TOFA, it's currently advised not to use it during pregnancy until we know a little bit more.
Yep.
Right? Okay, fabulous. I'll also mention that at the ACG meeting, which was just last week, there was a wonderful plenary presentation looking at cesarean section outcomes in women who were on biological therapies, and they demonstrated no increased risk for wound healing or infection problems in those women. So if the woman delivers vaginally or by cesarean section, safe to be on the therapies, and this just emphasizes what we have thought we knew about these treatments so far.
And the AGA pathway actually defines when you should resume the anti-TNF after vaginal or cesarean delivery. So it really provides guidance both what to do leading up to delivery as well as what clinicians should do after.
Right. Okay, well, we've actually lost Gil. I think it's a technical challenge rather than anything else, and we want to, of course, thank him very much. And I'm actually going to wrap up. I think we've had an incredible discussion here. I want to thank our audience for their contributions, their questions, and I want to, of course, thank my faculty, Dr. Jamie Kanukin from the University of Michigan and Dr. Gil Melmed from Cedars-Sinai. This has been an excellent discussion. I know we focused on a couple of different topics, but we also have really covered a lot of ground on IBD in our questions and answers. As a reminder, the animations you saw today will be available on the CME Outfitters website in the GI Hub of cmeoutfitters.com. CME Outfitters also maintains a YouTube channel, so you can check out those as well. Please visit the page regularly, and don't forget, if you'd like to get your CME or like to get the MIPS quality improvement points and mock points for this, I do want to emphasize that it's also helpful for you to fill out your evaluations so that we can learn from your interaction tonight and CME Outfitters can plan more great programs like this in the future. I really appreciate all of you joining us tonight. You've had a long day, and I hope what you've learned here will help those patients you take care of tomorrow. Thank you very much.